everyone, and welcome to another edition of Criminal Discourse Podcast. I'm Trish.
I'm Wendy.
We're back with you with an all-new episode. So before we get started, I understand, Wendy, you have some crime news updates. Not me for once.
Not you for once. But it is back to the same person I'm always updating you on. James Krausnick, convicted of the Brighton Axe murder in Brighton, New York, right outside of Rochester. The last time we talked about him, he was diagnosed with late stage cancer. He actually died in prison. That would be from esophageal cancer. And this is in the beginning of May when he passed away. So an interesting thing that the courts did there in New York is under state law. Now I'm reading this from the Democrat and Chronicle article that I found this information in, and they were a source that I used heavily in that podcast episode as well. They're the local newspaper there. So under state law, this is from the article, Krausnick's indictment for the crime will now be dismissed because of his pending appeal. So their logic is that the appeal did not have an opportunity to be considered, so the indictment should be dismissed because of the possibility of a successful appeal.
So it's like he was never convicted.
Kind of, sort of. But Kathleen Krausnick's sister, Annette Schlosser, said, quote, even though Jim did not serve his full sentence, we believe that karma was done when he died an undignified death behind prison walls. The entire world knows that he killed my sister and he died knowing that. So I, at first, wasn't totally satisfied with this outcome, but if Kathleen's family is happy with the outcome, then I am too.
There you go.
There it is.
Okay.
So I doubt we'll have very many more updates now on the Brighton Axe murder.
Got to get some updates on some other cases.
Case closed on that one, guys.
So we know there are so many true crime podcasts out there to choose from and only so many hours in the day. So we want to take a moment and thank you for choosing to listen to the discourse today. If you want to join the discourse, you can reach out to us on our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube at Criminal Dispod and Criminal Discourse Podcast. And one last thing, the views and opinions discussed on Criminal Discourse Podcast are just our opinions, and everyone is presumed innocent until convicted in a court of law.
Well, let's do it. What do you have for us this week, Trish?
So our case today takes place in Tennessee, and I think we've only done one other case episode on a case in Tennessee, so we're back around. So in May 1984, Murfreesboro, Tennessee was shaken by the brutal murder of Laura Salmon, a lifelong resident of the area. At the time, Laura was an 18-year-old college student attending Middle Tennessee State University. Her murder shocked the community and left investigators with plenty of circumstantial evidence, but not much hard proof. The case remained unsolved for over 16 years until new DNA evidence led to the arrest and conviction of their prime suspect. The murder of Laura Salmon remained a tragic reminder of the impact of dating violence on individuals and communities, and the testament to the tireless efforts of law enforcement to bring justice to the victims and their families. Now, this episode does deal with incidents of dating violence, and we're going to be describing some of those incidents that happened to Laura, so listener discretion is advised. So like I said, our episode takes place in Murfreesboro, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, so people from that area of Tennessee, I'm doing my best. As Wendy says, don't come at me.
Don't come at her. She's trying.
I'm trying.
Sounds right to me.
So this town is located approximately 35 miles southeast of the state of the capital of Nashville, and in 1818, Murfreesboro was the state capital for about 8 years, until Nashville took over the title. So Murfreesboro is known as an agricultural community for its corn, cotton, and tobacco products. Now, Murfreesboro is also called the Athens of Tennessee, and that is due to the number of academic institutions in the area. Now, one of those institutions is Middle Tennessee State University, or MTSU. That's what I'll try to refer to it as. MTSU is known for its aerospace programs, its concrete industry management programs, which I didn't even know was a major, and recording industry majors, because it's so close to Nashville.
That makes sense, yeah.
So some notable alumni from MTSU include Hillary Scott, singer-songwriter for the country group Lady A.
Wow.
Formerly Lady Antebellum, right? Mm-hmm. And actress Sandra Locke. Now, she starred in a lot of movies. I think like 6 movies with Clint Eastwood. They were in a relationship together for quite some time, even though I think both of them were married for some of that time. They starred in Any Which Way You Can, Any Which Way But Loose, I think Bronco Billy, The Gauntlet. So early Clint Eastwood films.
A lot of movies I don't know, Trish.
Right. But she was nominated for, I believe, a supporting actress right when she started out in Hollywood. The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. And Las Vegas WNBA player Alicia Clark. And also Vernis Fly Girl Armour, the first African-American female naval aviator in the Marine Corps and the first female combat aviator.
So Fly Girl as in literally a pilot, not Fly Girl from In Living Color, the TV show.
No, Fly Girl is that's her, I guess, handle or nickname she gets as an aviator combat pilot.
That's really cool.
It is cool. So on May 31st, 1984, farmer Johnny Muckle walked into the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office to report finding a body of a young woman lying in one of his fields, which was near a quarry. So when investigators, including Deputy Chief Robert Asbury, arrived at the location, they found just what the farmer reported, a white female lying on her back. She wore no other clothing but her bra. However, her body had been covered with two pairs of jeans and a jacket. So one of those pairs of jeans was Sergio Valente. I told you this. This was 80s.
Ooh.
Sergio Valente. And the other pair was a pair of men's rustler jeans, along with a black members only jacket. And that, again, they were laid on top of the victim. Now, one sleeve of the members only jacket had been tied around the victim's neck. The men's rustler's jeans were laid over the chest area of the victim while the Sergio Valente covered her private area and down one leg. Now, in the victim's right hand was clutched a pair of panties, presumably her own. The victim had visible injuries to the left side of her head, and several bloodstained rocks were found around her body. The area the victim was found in was known as a place for high school and local college students to gather and party, which again was located right next to this quarry. The victim was identified as 18-year-old Laura Salmon, a freshman at MTSU. Laura had attended Oakland High School, where her mother, Lorraine Mackey, taught English. Now, her parents were divorced, but at the time of Laura's murder, she had moved into her father's residence a few days prior, and this might have been due to it being the end of the school term. Now, I'm not sure because no reason was really given why she didn't move in with mom, but she moved in with dad. So Laura had been described as the girl next door. In preschool, she had been crowned Little Miss Murfreesboro. She acted in summer theater productions held at the Murfreesboro's Little Theater, and she graduated high school with high academic honors while participating in extracurricular activities such as the Flag Corps. In the fall 1983, Laura started attending MTSU while her boyfriend, David Kyle Gilley, finished his senior year at Oakland High School. The couple had been dating, having got together in 1982. So Dr. Charles Harlan performed Laura's autopsy on June 2nd, and he determined that Laura had received 10 different blows to her head with a blunt forced object, such as a heavy rock. The impact created a spider web of skull fractures. He also noticed discoloration in Laura's one eye that was consistent with trauma received from a fist or another type of blunt instrument. In his opinion, he wrote that Laura died as a result of a combination of wounds that caused fatal injuries to her brain. Dr. Harlan also noted that Laura did not show any signs of sexual assault, but did note that it looked like she had consensual sex within 24 to 48 hours of the murder. And I only think he termed it consensual because there was no bruising, there was no trauma to the vaginal area.
That makes sense, yeah.
The semen from Laura did not match the semen sample that they found on the pair of rustler jeans, though. So that kind of set off a question, what's going on here? The semen sample, interestingly enough, that was found on the rustler jeans was not found in the crotch area where one might think it would be located.
I'm puzzling right now. So there, does that mean there's two separate DNA profiles?
Yes.
Okay.
So Ralph LaHue, a sergeant with the sheriff's office, had worked the night shift the evening Laura's body was discovered, and her body was discovered in the afternoon of the 31st. He knew that Laura worked as a cashier at Kroger's grocery store on Tennessee Boulevard, so on patrol, he decided to see if he could locate her vehicle, a 1976 Oldsmobile Cutlass Salon, that is quite a car, which had yet to be found. His educated guess paid off, though, and at 12:40 a.m. on June 1st, Laura's car was located in the Kroger lot and taken into evidence. So no fingerprints, including Laura's, were found on the car, where you would at least expect Laura's to be found, like on the steering wheel, on the radio dial.
So we wiped the car now, a fingerprints maybe?
So what was found was one foreign hair, and dirt in its wheel wells and in the car. So dirt samples were sent off for testing either to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation or the FBI Crime Lab. I believe they were sent to both. Soil collected from the car was located on the driver's side floor mat, the front passenger side floor mat, the rear passenger side floor mat. So through microscopic analysis, investigators Aubrey Shaw with TBI, the Tennessee lab, and Ronald Rowalt with the FBI determined that Laura's vehicle had been on the road located near the crime scene as the dirt samples matched. So the dirt samples in the car, the dirt samples in the wheel well were from the same area.
And now the car is back at her workplace.
Correct.
Okay.
So when detectives informed Miss Mackey of her daughter's murder, she immediately told them Kyle had done it. So even though his name's David Kyle Gilly, he went by his middle name. She was sure of it. She would tell investigators of the toxic, violent relationship her daughter had with Kyle. Kyle had a reputation around Oakland High School for being possessive and jealous, and it seemed he lived up to that reputation. Now, Miss Mackey didn't approve of the relationship, seeing how upset her daughter would become when Gilly and her would argue. So much so that Miss Mackey wouldn't even allow Gilly inside her home. So maybe that's one of the reasons she moved in with Dad. I don't know. So it's unclear if Miss Mackey knew all that had transpired during her daughter's relationship with Gilly, which would be revealed through the investigation. But she knew enough to know that Gilly did not treat her daughter very well and was abusive. How abusive? I don't believe she totally knew. So investigators next talked to Laura's father and her stepmom, Brenda. Brenda told detectives that the last she saw of Laura was on the morning of May 31st. Laura and her friend, Trina, were sleeping in the den, having gotten back late from an evening out. Now, Mr. Salmon also saw Laura for the last time that morning when he left for work. Both would be informed of Laura's death that evening when Assistant District Attorney Guy Dotson came to their home. So Laura and Trina both worked at the Kroger grocery store together. They were childhood best friends. And when questioned, Trina told investigators that Laura had picked her up around 11 p.m. on May 30th, and the friends had gone to a nightclub in Nashville, returning around 3 a.m. The next morning, the pair drove to Kroger as Laura had a shift starting at 9 a.m. and Trina would return around 2 for the start of her shift. Now, when Trina arrived for her shift, Laura's car was gone, which she expected because she got off at 1 o'clock. However, she spotted Laura's car in the parking lot around 3:30 p.m., I think between 3:30, 3:45, when she was taking groceries out to a customer's car. This time, however, Laura's car was parked in a different spot. So Trina told investigators that Laura was afraid of her boyfriend. Trina knew that Laura had started seeing some other guys from NTSU, but she didn't want Gilly to know, as she was, quote, she was scared of what would happen if he ever found out. Laura wanted out of her relationship and had tried to end it before, but she was terrified of the fallout. Now, I've read various articles referring to Kyle Gilly as an ex-boyfriend, and an equal number that state the pair were still together in some form or fashion. And I think the truth lies somewhere in the middle, as Laura's fears were very real. And Gilly didn't seem to want to let her go.
We see that a lot of times when there's victims of domestic violence and the guy has this feeling of being led on. She wasn't telling me she didn't want to be, because she was terrified mm-hmm. of what would happen if she was very blunt and direct about it.
And there was one time she was, and there was, and we'll talk about that. So another employee at Kroger would tell authorities that she and Laura worked together on May 31st, and at the end of their shifts, they left together. Laura had changed out of her work clothes into a pair of Sergio Valente jeans, a top, and some brown shoes. Laura told her she was going to her grandmother's house to swim, so she watched Laura get into her car and drive off. She would also tell detectives that she had seen Laura black and blue on several occasions. She knew that Laura was seeing Kyle Gilly and told her that she should talk to someone and tell them what was going on, as physical abuse should not happen in a relationship. So on the evening of May 31st, Kyle Gilly had called the Salmon home, this is the father's residence, not long after they had been notified of Laura's murder. Mr. Salmon told Gilly he needed to go to the sheriff's office as they had some questions, and he did. Gilly told Detective Asbury that he had seen Laura on May 30th at her grandmother's place. They were there from about 6:30 till around 10:30, and he was supposed to meet up with her the next afternoon to go swimming at the grandmother's place, but he couldn't find her. Now, Gilly's statement was not a formal one, and he was not considered a suspect, so he was free to leave. Detective Asbury did not take any notes during this conversation. So on June 6th, Gilly came in for a formal interview and was read his Miranda rights. Now, Gilly's stepfather was also present for this interview because I believe at the time he was only 17 years old. So in this interview, Gilly told detectives that the pair left Laura's grandmother's apartment around 9 p.m. in his car. and they parked behind the Bellwood Church and proceeded to have sexual relations in the car. Not a spot I would choose, but afterwards, he drove them back to Laura's grandmother's house, and they both left around 10:30 p.m. in their respective vehicles. Gilly went off to work. He worked the third shift, and he assumed Laura drove back to her father's house, and Gilly got off work around 7 a.m. He said he drove home, went straight to bed, and he didn't wake up until about anytime between 3 and 4 p.m. Now, Gilly's stepfather wouldn't tell investigators that when he got off work around 3 p.m., Gilly was asleep when he arrived home and only left for about a half hour when he went looking for Laura around 5 p.m., and then he returned at 5:30. So, another interview took place in July 1984. This time, Gilly was interviewed by Tom Carmucci, a Tennessee Bureau of Investigation agent. Gilly told Carmucci that he had been in Florida until May 29th, and he told the agent the same information he had told in his previous interview. But this time, he added that after he and Laura had finished having sex, they cleaned themselves off with a pair of jeans he had in his car. Now, after he got off work, he went home and didn't get up till around 4:40 p.m. And Gilly told Agent Carmucci that he only found out Laura had been murdered when he went to the sheriff's office. So when Mr. Salmon said, hey, you need to go to the sheriff's office, he did, with Mr. Salmon not telling him that Laura was dead. So, and maybe he didn't ask why, you know, so there's some definitely some suspicious stuff going on here. So when Agent Carmucci suggested to Gilly that he had no way of knowing that Laura went straight home after they left their grandmother's house, Gilly jumped out of his chair looking agitated, stating that she wouldn't do that. And we know that she didn't go back home. She picked up Trina when she got off work at 11 p.m. and the pair went into Nashville clubbing.
Interesting.
So while detectives were building a timeline, another suspect showed up on their radar. A woman who lived in Nashville contacted police claiming she had been raped. Her attacker mentioned Laura's name during the attack, telling her he would do the same thing to her as he did to Laura. Now, detectives were able to track down this woman's rapist, who, to their surprise, also attended MTSU. He was also a member of the same gym Laura went to and frequented the same fraternity parties she attended. And they were also able to determine that he was near campus the day Laura was murdered. So you can guess who jumped to the top of the suspect list there. This suspect also had a history of violence against women. So a forensic chemist with the FBI compared the hair found in Laura's car to the new suspect. Now, since DNA was still years away, they had no way to know for certain. And all the lab could determine is that the hair found in Laura's car was consistent with a new suspect. But since a single hair is not enough to charge someone, investigators needed more. We need to kind of tie him to the scene, right?
Yeah.
So next, detectives looked at the men's jeans found at the crime scene. They had a waist size of 30 inches and an inseam of 36. Now, for their new suspect, it was a bust, as those jeans would have been way too long for him. So this was not the only dead end investigators had, in that they questioned close to 100 suspects, but nothing seemed to pan out. So they couldn't really connect one prime person to the crime scene. Gilly has the alibi from his stepfather, and this suspect, you know, okay, we have maybe consistent one hair piece.
Can't exclude him.
Can't exclude him, but can't really tie him to it. And the jeans are way too big for him to wear, so they're probably not his. And all of these other suspects that they questioned, nothing seemed to pan out. So there were also issues that arose during the investigation that may not have filled Laura's family in with much confidence that her killer would ever be caught. One example of this was when Laura's father had gone to the crime scene once it was released by police, and he discovered Laura's necklace lying on the ground, along with several blood-stained rocks. He collected those items and turned them over to authorities like, hey, you forgot these.
You missed a spot.
Yeah. So years later, it would be discovered that the crime scene had not even been secured overnight after the discovery of Laura's body. It was also reported detectives hadn't worn gloves when they gathered some of the evidence at the scene. Now, this was the 80s. You wore gloves. Mm-hmm. Also, a formal statement from a man that found Laura's body was never taken.
The farmer?
The farmer.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
Still, Laura's case was never closed. It never was. And over the years, other detectives would look at the file with fresh eyes, hopefully they could nail down a suspect. Now, it would take 16 years for Laura's case to finally be solved. In 2000, cold case detectives Bill Sharp and Dan Goodman with the Rutherford County Sheriff's Office would be assigned the task of tracking down Laura's killer. And Dan Goodman had a special connection to Laura's case, as he knew her from MTSU. So Dan Goodwin had belonged to the same fraternity at MTSU, and Laura was one of the little sisters of their frat. He and Laura had even gone out on a date to the movies 4 days prior to her murder. They saw The Natural with Robert Redford.
Okay, that's a movie I know.
Okay. So at the funeral, Dan approached Laura's mom and pledged to find out who killed her daughter. And Goodwin would take a winding road into law enforcement, having started out actually as a newspaper reporter. He even wrote about Laura's unsolved case along with others in a 1987 article for the Daily News Journal. Goodwin would eventually leave journalism and become a police officer. That really, I think, is where his passion lied. And one of his first official cases was Laura's murder. He hoped to finally make good on his promise to Miss Mackey. So one of the first things Sharpman Goodwin did was they sent all the evidence off to the TBI lab for updated testing. We're now in 2000, and technology now existed to find out whose semen was on that pair of Rustler jeans. They also started reviewing all of the old interviews and case files to see if they could find any new leads. And one new lead did come their way in 2000, and it had come from an Oakland high school student who was overheard talking about Laura's case, stating that his father had killed her and thrown her body in the quarry. So this student's father did have a police record for aggravated assault, but by the time detectives could track down their possible suspect, he was dead. Detectives did ask the suspect's children for the DNA sample, which they provided. And in the end, that sample did not match the DNA found at Laura's murder scene. They also tested the rapist DNA from years earlier, the one that the hair was kind of inconsistent for, and that also was not a match. So even Detective Goodwin gave his DNA, since again, he had been out with Laura 4 days prior, and that was also not a match. So one suspect detectives could not rule out, even after 16 years, was Kyle Gilley. The only thing that didn't keep them from going, I think, after him hard was that alibi from his stepfather that he was home. Now, during a review of Laura's file, detectives found a note contradicting Gilley's alibi that he was home at the time of Laura's murder. And again, she was believed to have been murdered, I think, somewhere between when she got off work and about 3:30 when the car was found, 3:30, 3:45 in the lot. The note that they found in the file indicated a female witness had identified Gilley's driving Laura's car approximately a half mile from the road that led to the quarry where Laura's body was found.
That's a big lead.
Yeah, it is. That's written right in the file for 16 years. Detectives wanted to know more about what this witness had to say, and so they tracked her down. Her name was Gladys, and at the time of Laura's murder, she was an employee at the Heatcraft Division of Lennox Industries. She told detectives that she was traveling home from work the afternoon of May 31st when she saw a two-tone beige Oldsmobile Cutlass, and this car was at the intersection of Twin Hoke and Halls Pike. The Oldsmobile was on the road leading away from the quarry, and she remembered waiting for the car to move. So they're at this intersection, you know, like, you go, I go, you. And this car's just sitting there, and she's like, okay. And so she proceeds through the intersection because the car's not moving. And when she learned about the murder the next day, she went into work and told several coworkers and her boss of what she had encountered at that intersection near the crime scene. So Gladys was given a photo array back in 1984, and she was able to pick Gilley out as the person she saw behind the wheel of the car. She remembered he had a slender build, dark shoulder-length hair, and he appeared tall based on the position of the front seat because it was pushed back. So she, again, had notified the sheriff's office after she had seen a photo of Gilley in the newspapers. Okay, she heard about the murder. She told her coworkers. I think photos were showing up in the local newspaper. And she's like, wait, that's the guy that I saw car. So she notifies police. And she was interviewed by TBI agent Carmucci several months later after the murder. And that is when she picked out the picture of Gilley in the photo lineup. And she told the agent then, when she drove through the intersection, what really stood out to her, besides the car not moving, was that the driver just sat there, staring straight ahead with a blank look on his face.
And I could see this as the detectives weighing the stepfather's alibi over her sighting of him in her car. But then you have to take into account the abuse in that relationship. I assume that people are telling the investigators about that as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Detective Sharp and Goodwin re-interviewed old witnesses and came across some new ones in their re-examination of Laura's case. The picture that started to take shape was a violent one. Back in 1984, it was violent. It didn't get any better 16 years later. One of those witnesses was a friend and neighbor of Laura's. Her name is Kim. And she told detectives that she had been at the police station to answer some questions at the same time Gilly was the night Laura's body was found. So afterwards, she had gotten a ride home with Gilly, who wanted to go to Laura's father's house. And of course, she lived right across the street. So while at the Salmon residence, Kim witnessed Gilly going through Laura's belongings and taking some letters. So then Kim and Gilly went to a party. And it was at this party that Gilly made a pass at her, telling Kim, quote, "Laura's dead. She won't know."
So that's a pickup line if there ever was one.
So after leaving the party, due to feeling uncomfortable, they're outside talking in the parking lot. And Kim claimed that Gilly kept asking her why Laura cheated on him and why she did this to him. Now, Kim, she decided, her instincts were going off. So she got another ride home, wanting to get away from Gilly as she was frightened by his behavior. So a new witness that original investigators never questioned was Shelley. She was a sophomore at Oakland High School when Gilly was a senior in 1984. And she had met Gilly at a keg party where the two then left to go off to the rock quarry off Twin Oak Drive. She related that at one point, Gilly had asked her if she, quote, wanted to end up like Laura Salmon, unquote. She asked, well, who's that? So I don't know if this girl just moved to the area. She didn't seem to know about the Laura Salmon case and what he was talking about. And Gilly replied, she was his ex-girlfriend and I killed her. Now, when Shelley got home, she told her father, who told her to keep her mouth shut. And she would not come forward until June 2000.
That's bad dad advice.
Well, it's also 1984.
Yes.
And he could have been worried about his own daughter. I'm not going to. That is bad dad advice. But if this guy was violent and had a history of violence.
No, you're right. But that's also putting in my mind the idea that we kind of understand the connection between violence in relationships and murder. But then from the investigator's side, it's still that, well, you know, maybe he beat her up. But that, you know, we got this alibi that doesn't make him the primo suspect in this case. Mm-hmm. There's kind of a disconnect there.
The 80s were a different time. We'll talk about that. So meanwhile, the TBI lab was busy re-examining the evidence, focusing on the Rustler jeans. Crime scene technicians found bloodstains only above the knees, indicating that Laura's assailant was wearing them and kneeling over her at the time of the attack. The blood spatter was a medium velocity spatter, which indicated to them that some instrument, like a rock, had been used as it had not generated much force. So there wasn't a major swing, I think. The blood spatter on those jeans belonged to Laura. So from the semen sample, a DNA profile was found. And now all the detectives needed to do was find out who it belonged to. And they focused their efforts in tracking down Kyle Gilly, who is no longer living in Murfreesboro. Kyle Gilly had relocated to Bradenton, Florida in 1986, where he worked in the Public Works Department for Manatee County. Now, Rich Gerken, a sergeant with the Manatee County Sheriff's Office, assisted Sharp and Goodwin on May 9th, 2000. He had gotten the background information on the case for them, and he went to question Gilly on their behalf. Now, Gilly told Gerken that he had no knowledge of a rock quarry prior to Laura's murder. Didn't know it existed. He denied being jealous or physically violent with Laura. He denied having sex with her for even 2 to 3 days prior to the murder. Now, a blood sample was taken once he was served a warrant, which was then sent immediately off to the TBI lab in Tennessee for testing. So on May 31st, 2000, Gilly's DNA sample was run against the semen sample found on the Rustler jeans. And it was on the 16th anniversary of Laura's murder that those results would show that Kyle Gilly was the donor of that sample and most likely had been wearing those jeans when he killed Laura by kneeling over her and beating her with rocks. So Detective Goodwin would return to Florida on November 13th, 2001 for another interview. Gilly signed a statement following his interview where he claimed that his relationship with Laura was mostly sexual and that they both saw other people and neither of them was jealous. He once again denied being violent towards Laura or any other woman. He did admit that Laura had chipped a tooth once when they were fooling around and she jumped on him. And he denied ever visiting Laura at her dorm on the MTSU campus and denied ever having visited the rock quarry. Gilly also denied having gone to the Salmon residence the night of her murder. The only thing he did admit to was, maybe those Rustler jeans were mine. I did wear Rustler.
Ignoring all of his testimony, or not his testimony, his witness statements from 1984, his interviews, all the other witness statements.
Sure, 16 years later.
Jeez, who peats.
So Detective Goodwin Well, he was good, as he got on the record all of Gilly's denials, some of which Goodwin personally knew were false. Goodwin remembered seeing Gilly with Laura on the MTSU campus together. He also knew from Gilly's 1984 statement, just like you said, that he had been to the rock quarry twice. Detective Goodwin informed Gilly that he had an expert who would testify that Laura's killer had been wearing those wrestler jeans at the time of her murder, and that's when Gilly asked for an attorney. So on November 14, 2001, David Kyle Gilly was arrested in Bradenton, Florida, and charged with first-degree murder. Now, since Gilly was underage at the time of Laura's murder, he was 17, he was arraigned in juvenile court instead of an adult criminal one. Now, in 2002, a hearing would take place to determine if Gilly should be transferred to the adult circuit court. Now, after various witnesses testified as to the violent relationship between Gilly and Laura, juvenile court judge Donna Scott ruled that Gilly would be tried as an adult. And this order came down on February 1st, 2002. So on March 6, 2002, a grand jury indicted him formally on first-degree murder charges. So before the trial could even start, a pretrial hearing took place on November 27th, 2002. And this was to determine which witnesses would be allowed in and which would be excluded. Now, at the end of this two-day hearing, the court ruled that they would allow the following witnesses to give testimony as to incidents that occurred between 1982 and 1984. One was Laura's mother, Lorraine Mackey. There were three other witnesses, Connie, Melinda, and Terry, we'll talk about them, who would be allowed to testify to incidents where they witnessed Gilly pulling Laura by her hair, pushing her face into hoods of cars, to lockers, other witnesses that would testify him repeatedly driving by the MTSU campus, kind of stalking her and twisting her arm once, and an incident that occurred in the dormitories.
And I assume that time frame, the year 1982, is from when he and Laura started dating.
Yes.
Correct. Okay.
Yes. So the trial court felt that there was clear and convincing evidence that these incidences were relevant in showing Gilly's, quote, motive, intent, hostility, and settled purpose, unquote, and that it was to harm Laura Salmon. Both the defense and prosecution either wanted more witness testimony allowed in or some more to be excluded, depending on which side you were on. So both sides appealed, and after a 2.5-year delay, the Tennessee Supreme Court returned the case back to the circuit court, saying it was up to Judge Ash to ultimately decide who would be allowed in and who would be excluded. So basically, what had already been decided in 2002. This is the wheels of justice moving slowly. So on August 26, 2006, David Kyle Gilly's trial began for the murder of Laura Salmon, whom he was accused of murdering a little over 22 years prior.
So he's in his 30s now, going to trial in his 30s.
So the following is testimony giving at trial. Please note that some of these incidents are unsettling. So Mary testified, and she was a resident advisor in Laura's dorm, and she testified that she knew Gilly as someone who had visited Laura on certain visitation nights. And one night at the end of February, or the very beginning of March 84, so a few months before Laura's murder, Mary was informed by several dorm residents of loud arguing coming from Laura's room. So Mary went to her room, she knocked on the door several times, and she could hear this heated argument occurring inside. When Laura finally answered the door, that is when Mary saw, one, she had been crying, and she had mascara smeared all over her face. She had a bruise on her right cheek, and her nose was bleeding. And that's when Mary stepped in and said, "You need to leave." She told Gilly he needed to get out. And Gilly proceeded to call her a bitch and told her to mind her own business. Gilly then called Laura a two-timing bitch and a whore, and then grabbed her by the arm and hair, dragging her down the hallway towards the stairwell. Gilly then lifted Laura up and over the third floor railing, shouting, "I will kill you. I will drop you and kill you." Eventually, Gilly brought her back over the rail and left.
Now that's important.
And this is information they would have had back in 1984.
And they said he's not a suspect.
So Michael, who had gone to high school together with Laura and Gilly, had testified to an incident at one of the high school dances in which Gilly held Laura's hand while jerking her around by her hair and yelling at her. Now, Michael went to separate the pair, and that is when he saw that Gilly had a large clump of her hair in his hand. He had yanked her around that hard. Melinda was also in high school with the couple, and she testified to Gilly banging Laura's head into the locker one day. Gilly told Laura that she wasn't going to break up with him, and he threatened to kill her right there in school. And Melinda was also present for another incident at the party tree, what they called the party tree. This was an area off Sulphur Springs Road where kids would meet up to hang out on weekends. So Gilly held Laura by the back of her hair and smashed her head against the window of the car door. Melinda would leave and notify police, but I could find no information of any police involvement, whether they showed up, whether they just separated them, or it was over by the time they got there. I don't know.
It's just some teens arguing, you know.
Also, if you're noticing, I'm not giving last names. I'm doing that purposely just to protect their identities in terms of this. All this information I did get from the appeal that I do have in the show notes. So if you want to know their names, you can go there. So Connie also witnessed the incident at the party tree and one that occurred at band practice. So this is while they're still in high school, when Gilly grabbed Laura's arm and tried to get her to leave with him. Connie also read some letters Gilly had sent Laura, in which he had apologized, professed his love, and threatened her that if he couldn't have her, no one could. So Laura, I believe when she was alive, had shared these letters with Connie. And these may have been the letters that he took from Laura's house that night.
Absolutely.
Reed, he worked at the Murphy Burroughs Little Theater and worked on a play with Laura in 1983. He recalled Gilly had been sitting in his car one evening and Laura was standing outside the window. And I believe it was Gilly's car. They're not really too sure whose car it was, so I assume it was his and not Laura's. And the two were arguing, and Laura had tried to reach through the open window to grab the keys, and Gilly rolled it up on her arm. Keep in mind, this was
you
used to have to crank the wheel to get those windows up. They wasn't electric. He then proceeded to drive away, dragging Laura onto the street. Now, Laura was able to get her arm free, but she went sprawling into the road.
That would be traumatic. These are traumatic things to hear about, just to witness. There's more.
So Miss Mackey, Laura's mother, testified that one day Laura had come into her classroom crying about something Gilly had said to her. I don't know if this was the day where he threatened, you know, that she tried to break up with him and he threatened to kill her. And Miss Mackey confronted Gilly about his behavior towards her daughter. And she claimed that Gilly, you know, he could have cared less about what she was telling him. Oh. So the prosecution also presented their theory of what occurred the afternoon of May 31st. They believe that Gilly and Laura did have plans to meet up and go swimming that afternoon, but Gilly convinced Laura to head out to the deserted Lover's Lane to talk. Now, did he know that she had gone out clubbing the night before? The talk soon turned to arguing, with Gilly pinning Laura down and straddling her. He then grabbed the closest objects he could find on the ground, which were the rocks of various sizes, and he repeatedly struck her in the head. Gilly saw that he had gotten blood on the upper part of his jeans, and that is the reason he left them there. And DNA testing, again, would match the semen found on those jeans to the blood spatter belonging to Laura. So Gladys also testified to her witnessing Gilly driving Laura's car that afternoon at the intersection of Twin Oaks and Hall Pike. She recounted the same information that she told detectives back in 1984. And to bolster her testimony, Billy, who was her supervisor at the time, he testified to a conversation they had at work back in 1984. Billy remembered Gladys telling him when she heard about Laura's murder and the location where it occurred and what she saw. So the defense, for their part, claimed Gilly was innocent of Laura's murder. They tried to show the presence of another man's DNA as proof of someone else was at the crime scene. Now, this other sample of DNA has never been tied to anyone and no one's ever come forward. So this could have been someone she met in Nashville at the club, you know, or just didn't want to get involved.
That does bother me. But yet it also doesn't, the same way that they're trying to use it as proof that Gilly could be innocent, it also doesn't mean that that other DNA supplier was guilty of this crime.
Right. So they also had Gilly's brother testify as an alibi witness. He testified on the day of the murder, he had gotten off work and come home sometime between noon and 1 p.m., and Gilly was asleep when he arrived. And he left the house around 1:30 for about 90 minutes, and when he returned, both his father and Gilly were there. When he left again around 4:30 p.m., Gilly was just getting up. And he claims he saw no bruises or scratches on Gilly. So I believe the stepfather may have been passed away by the time this trial took place, and that's why he didn't testify. But on cross-examination, Gilly's brother admitted to writing a letter to Gilly while he was in jail, telling him, don't worry, he would provide him an alibi. So David Kyle Gilly was found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced using the 1984 state sentencing laws, and he got 30 years in prison.
Oh.
He will be eligible for parole in September 25, 2042.
Okay. I don't know that I'm super happy about that, but I guess there's not a whole lot we can do, is there? I guess if he would have been sentenced back in 1984, he'd already be out, so...
Laura Salmon died at the hands of someone who professed to love her, but saw her as someone to control and own. Laura had tried to end her relationship with Gilly several times, but he threatened and beat her when she did. She was terrified of Gilly, perhaps didn't feel she would have much support to break away from him. Unfortunately, back then, domestic violence, and specifically dating violence, it was never really talked about. It was thought to be a private matter between two people. But 4 months after Laura's murder, a television movie would bring awareness and become part of a national conversation around the issue of domestic violence. So that television movie was based on the book by Faith McNulty entitled The Burning Bed, which aired on October 8, 1984 on NBC. The Burning Bed was based on the true story of battered housewife Francine Hughes. Actress Farrah Fawcett, best known for her famous swimsuit poster and playing Jill Monroe on Charlie's Angels, played Francine. So this movie really showed the brutal reality of domestic violence, unlike anything that had ever been seen on primetime television at that time. We didn't have 24-hour access or thousands of streaming channels, cable news, nothing like that. So this movie, which I think still holds the record as one of the highest movies to air on a national broadcasting channel. It's like eighth, I think, of all the movies that have been out. Really, I remember watching this movie and being like, holy crap. Like, it was unlike anything I had ever seen at that point. Now, showing by today's standards, probably not.
I think I saw it on a replay on Lifetime when I was younger in the 90s, and I still remember it being hugely impactful. And then I eventually bought the book, and the book, I mean, as you can imagine, is even worse. But yeah, I think it still has an impact. I mean, go watch it. If you're questioning how domestic violence was handled in the 80s, this will tell you.
Right. Well, actually, her incident took place back in the 70s, like late 70s, early 80s. So what had happened was basically after 13 years of abuse and brutal beatings from her husband, Francine set fire to his bed while he was passed out in it one night in March 1977. And she turned herself into police the next day, telling him what she had done. And she would eventually go on trial for his murder, but she would be found not guilty by reason of temporary insanity. So not in terms of protecting herself, not in terms of, because he had, I believe what kicked off her finally doing something was that he had brutally, brutally beaten her when she came home late from a college class she was taking. She was trying to better herself. And he just, it was horrible what he did to her, how he beat her in front of the kids, how he threatened to beat the kids, how he smashed her face. You know, she's trying to cook dinner and he's like pushing her face into the food on the floor. I mean, it was horrible.
Treated her like a dog.
Yeah.
And this worse. This is where, you know, the police come out, but they say, and they see the evidence of the abuse and they say, well, we didn't see him hit you. So unless someone sees it, it didn't really happen.
So another first in 1984 was the passage of the Violence Against Women Act that gave more protections to abused women. Now, increased awareness and the passage of tougher laws did little to help Laura Salmon at the time. According to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, intimate partner violence accounts for about 15% of all violent crimes here in the U.S. And it is women between the ages of 18 and 24 that are most commonly abused by their intimate partner. So, relational abuse is all about power and control. According to loveisrespect.org, it is not about love. Love is Respect recommends that people experiencing relational abuse, that they keep a journal of what they're experiencing, such as writing down, were there any witnesses, where this occurred, incident dates, times, descriptions, in case, like you just said, you need proof to the police to even get like a PFA or for someone to be charged.
And that's exactly what Nicole Brown Simpson did as well and helped her case in the future.
Well,
so, didn't help it at the time, but retrospectively, we were able to see what was really happening in that relationship.
So document abuse. They also recommend to document abuse with photos if you can and to seek medical attention when necessary. But most importantly, file a police report when it's safe for you to do so. And there are more protections today and resources today than Laura had back in 1984.
Yeah, just because the system doesn't always step in and help you in your situation doesn't mean that you should stop attempting to help yourself or help your friends if they're in that situation.
And there's more knowledge today. And I think law enforcement in general has more training today on domestic violence situations. They know how dangerous they are, how police officers even have lost their own lives in responding to domestic violence situations. So again, there's more protections today. Do not stay in a violent relationship. There are places that can help you and resources out there. I have some of them in the show notes. I put Love is Respect in there and also the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. There's a link in there for that information. So all of the resources I used are, like I said, in our resource section. There was a forensic file on this case. So just a last note on this, because we've talked about this, like, why did it take so long when all this information was back in 1984? You had the alibi witness who said, no, I saw him on that road at this time, how it was let go. So the only thing the forensic file episode says, it's a mystery why detectives didn't pursue this witness back in 1984. I'm not going to beseech the police in any way, shape, or form. I think, like, they needed that harder connection. You had an adult saying, no, he was home. And then you had this woman that was saying, no, it was him that I saw at the intersection. And eyewitness testimony isn't always reliable. So you need something more. But it doesn't seem like they pushed it as hard as they did till the 2000s when Dan Goodwin and Bill Sharp came on. So hats off to them to really pursue this. And Dan Goodwin made good on his promise to Miss Mackey to find her daughter's killer.
Yes, he did. I think, too, you also have in this case with Laura the added disadvantage of their age. Mm-hmm. Being a teenage couple, we don't take things like that quite as seriously, but we see it all the time. People as young as 13, 14 being murdered by their boyfriend mm-hmm. over things like this. And it's things that are witnessed in school. The parents know about it. And I really feel for her mom, and I don't know about her dad, but knowing that that's the situation and feeling like there's nothing I can do, I can't get through to my daughter. No one else is stepping in to help this. That's an impossible situation.
Yeah, it was a different time. Doesn't make it right what happened to her, but she finally got justice. Though a little delayed, she got justice.
She got it.
All right, everybody. Thank you for taking the time to listen. We, like I said earlier, greatly appreciate it.
So if you want to join the discourse, you have anything to add about this case, you know, other information that we didn't cover, or maybe you have other cases to suggest for us, you can always reach out to us on our website, criminaldiscoursepodcast.com, or on social media, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, at Criminal Dispod, or at Criminal Discourse Podcast. And if you enjoyed our telling of this case, you want to share it with a friend, we really appreciate that. You want to give us a review, a rating, 5 stars. We love those on whatever app you're listening to. We also appreciate that as well.
Yes. All right. As we always end the episode, if you see something, say something. You might have that missing piece of the puzzle it takes to solve a crime. I'll say in this case, people did say they gave their interviews. They told what they saw. Unfortunately, that wasn't enough. The DNA in time made it a stronger case than it would have been back in 1984. So until next time, guys, we want you to stay safe out there, but we also need to look out for one another too and be kind to one another. So until next time, bye.